Radio Netherlands, the home of high frequency since 1927.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives.
This is the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine for shortwave listeners. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and we'll start this time with a report on a rather interesting example of cooperation, which started in the US last week, but was also marked by stations in many countries in Europe, including us here in Holland. On the line from Boston, Massachusetts, USA, is Lou Josephs, and I think the airwaves were somewhat united with you last week, Lou.
Yes, Jonathan, all at once at 10:50 a.m. New York time, 15:50 UTC Friday, radio stations and networks across the United States aired the 6-minute, 22-second version of the USA for Africa single, We Are the World. The Good Friday broadcast was organized by a couple of disc jockeys, Bob Wolf, who works down in Rome, Georgia, and Don Brisker, also in Rome, Georgia. About 75% of all U.S. commercial stations, including some of the non-commercial ones, too, participated in this event. Here in the Boston area, we have 40 signals that we can hear, and approximately 35 of those were playing We Are the World.
It wasn't just the United States, though.
No, it also was 25 countries worldwide, including the Armed Forces Radio Network, the BBC, French Youth Media Union, the West German State Radio, and also the Voice of America, which transmitted the song to parts of Eastern and Southern Asia.
And what was the idea? Simply to draw attention to it, or also to raise royalty money?
Well, it's mainly to call attention to the fact that it was Good Friday, and it was a worldwide gesture.
10:49, in about 30 seconds here in Boston. It's good to have you along, Bill Silver, and welcome to part of the family of WROR, as we join thousands of the radio stations across the country and other major radio stations and broadcast facilities around the world, the significance, of course, being Good Friday.
And was it simply on pop music radio stations?
No, Jonathan, it wasn't. You could hear it on all news stations, on talk stations, classical stations. And, Jonathan, if you were in a store or shop doing a little shopping, you would have heard it on that annoying service that you find in stores called Muzak.
All right, there's the radio side, but I understand it's not going too well on the idea of direct satellite broadcasting in the United States, or DBS.
Well, the first direct satellite broadcasting system here was established about 17 months ago using Ku-band technology off one of the Canadian Anik satellites. United States Satellite Communications 5-channel satellite broadcasting service, which included such popular satellite offerings as Home Box Office and the Cable News Network, went dark on April 1st, and it wasn't an April Fool's joke. Several thousand subscribers in Middle Atlantic and Midwestern states have a small Ku-band Earth station in their backyard, but no satellite programming. And it's unlikely that the service will reappear.
Why is that? Has it simply not been a financial success?
It hasn't been a financial success, and they've lost a lot of money on it, and they can't find a corporate white knight to bail them out.
While direct satellite broadcasting of TV programs seems to hit snags, the Voice of America has issued a press release indicating that its audience is up by 10 million to 120 million listeners a week. In a statement issued in Washington, in fact before the BBC's announcement last week that it also had 120 million listeners, VOA director-designate Jean Pell said that the estimate is underrepresented, as it doesn't include people primarily in Africa and Latin America who listen to Voice of America programs relayed by local stations. The Voice of America has also announced increases to its daily broadcasts in Arabic, Turkish and Portuguese to Africa, bringing the total to over 1,000 program hours a week for the first time in 30 years. Further major expansion is planned in Spanish and Arabic later this year, and in doing so, more transmitters are being brought into operation. A new 500-kilowatt transmitter has been purchased from the British company of Marconi to be installed in Greenville, North Carolina. And in the UK, the Voice of America station at Wooferton extended its output and cut back on the number of BBC programmes that it also puts out. Building of a new relay station is also underway, as Christian Settle now reports from Mexico City.
Local press reports here supply further details on the planned installation of a VOA relay station in Belize. Mexico City's daily, La Jornada, on March 27th, said that in accordance with an agreement signed by Belize's former Prime Minister, George Price, and the United States government, the American personnel have started the construction of two relay transmitters at Punta Gorda. The relay should be operational before the end of this year and is believed to be medium wave. The agreement has been confirmed by Manuel Esquivel, Belize's current prime minister, and the new station's target area covers the whole of Central America from the southeast of Mexico to Costa Rica. But currently, Radio Belize is already relaying some of Voice of America's newscasts as well as some other programs. The agreement between Belize and the United States also includes the modernization of Radio Belize's equipment, including a 1 kilowatt transmitter already on the Punta Gorda site. The total cost for the construction of the VOA relay amounts to $42 million, which equals two-thirds of Belize's foreign debt.
It's fiesta time in Guadalajara. Then I long to be back once again in old Mexico.
Now let me change the subject slightly, since I ought to add a postscript to my report last week on the reactivation of shortwave stations in Mexico. I remarked that XEQK, La Hora Exacta, a station which includes a time signal every minute as part of its programs, appeared to have decided not to reactivate its shortwave transmitter. No sooner had I said that than at about 2000 hours UTC on 9555, I noted the station had resumed transmission on its traditional shortwave outlet in parallel with 1350. The current shortwave schedule is still unknown, but it may well be 24 hours, like the medium wave service. I decided to call the station to ask the reason for the reactivation of the shortwave service, but no one appeared to know anything about it.
Dit is Radio Free Suriname, onder auspiciën van de Raad voor Bevrijding van Suriname, de stem van het vrije Surinaamse volk.
The sound of Radio Free Suriname, which compiles its programs directed against the present government in Suriname from a small studio on the outskirts of The Hague in the Netherlands. They used to send a cassette to a small station in Venezuela, but reception proved to be unreliable. Clearly, they have found friends elsewhere, as the same liberation program has been heard on La Voz del Cid, an operation with offices based in Miami, Florida. For some weeks now, the program has been going out between 1930 and 1945, when normal Spanish transmissions resume. The frequencies are 9940 and 11680 kilohertz. This seems to indicate a closer cooperation among exile groups opposing their governments. Already previously noted between La Voz del Cid and Radio 15 of September, the latter being a clandestine broadcast aimed against the present Sandinista government in Nicaragua.
A report from Christian Settle, which was presented in our studios by Pete Myers. The often reasonable signal strength of the Radio Free Suriname programmes here in Holland may indicate they hope the programmes will also be heard by the Suriname community here. Finally, US press reports indicate that Charles E. Wick of the US Information Agency told Congress last week that Radio Marti is expected on the air in late May. This is the latest in a long line of dates mentioned for the start of 14 and a half hours of programmes daily in Spanish, beamed specifically from the Florida Keys across the water to Cuba.
You're listening to Media Network, and this is InfoDutch.
There seems to be a growing interest in the ability to control many functions of a shortwave receiver by using a home computer. we had a healthy pile of postcards inquiring about the interface designed for an ICOM ICR70 together with a Sinclair ZX81 by the Tros Radio here in Holland. We broadcast that feature a few weeks back, and we plan to translate those plans in June. Roger Broadbent has news of other units appearing.
In West Germany, the magazine Radio Welt has published details of a very simple cable to connect to the games port of an Apple IIe computer. The other end of the cable goes into the back of the new Yaesu FRG8800 shortwave receiver, recently launched on the world market. That's made so simple by the use of some very clever software developed by the magazine's technical editor, Rainer Lichter. The program has been written mostly in BASIC, with some of the control functions in machine code. These would have to be changed to make the program suitable for other brands of computers, though. The operator has the possibility to change both frequency and mode of the receiver, and there's also a 50-channel memory for favorite stations. A printer can be used to print out the database of stations, and versions available next month will include time-switching possibilities. A version for the Commodore 64 is also being developed. Note, though, that the program is written in German. The price for the program disc is 20 German marks, including postage in Germany, with an extra 10 Deutschmarks needed if you can't make up the connecting cable yourself. Now, if you'd like further information, then write to Rainer Lichter, I'll spell that name, R-A-I-N-E-R, Rainer, L-I-C-H-T-E, Rainer Lichter, Bremer Strasse, Strasse is S-T-R-A-S-S-E, 176, D-2940, Wilhelmshaven in West Germany. That's Rainer Lichter, Bremer Strasse, 176, D-2940, Wilhelmshaven in West Germany.
Meanwhile, in the United States, the Electronic Equipment Bank in Vienna, Virginia, is working towards improving an interface between a Commodore 64 home computer and a variety of shortwave receivers. One's existed for an amateur radio transmitter and receiver from Yaesu since last September, but a version for the Yaesu FRG8800 is expected soon. EEB's owner, Dick Robinson, told us work is going ahead on two types of interfaces for the ICOM ICR71 and also a Commodore computer. The standard version will allow you to control the receiver from the computer keyboard, and as you tune, if you hit the return key, the station's frequency and the time of day is added to the computer's database of stations you want to hear. The aim is to make the program suitable for non-technical users, as well as, of course, the computer buffs, thus opening shortwave listening to a new market. This product is being aimed for the start of July 1985. A more advanced unit, with up to 500 memories, will be released later. But I put it to Dick Robinson, haven't they had experience with computers interfering with shortwave reception due to the noise generated by the microprocessor?
One of the big problems we found with our customers having interference problems is they're using a, let's say, a receiver with an indoor active antenna next to their computer. And if they use good shielding techniques and grounding and get their antenna away from that receiver, we haven't had any problems. We will have a complete hardware-software package with all the cables that will plug directly into the R71A and plug that directly to the computer. But they're isolated, but they are electrically connected.
Well, Jonathan, with the growth in telephone modems for computers, the idea is also to create an option to connect the shortwave receiver to the Commodore computer and a telephone modem. In North America, a tone system is used to dial the phone, and the idea here is that you could set up a shortwave listening post anywhere you like, and then, from a completely different location, from a telephone box perhaps, remotely tune the receiver just by pushing the buttons on the telephone. Well, the mind boggles at the possibilities.
Now, where's Tristan da Cunha?
In California, home of the original Silicon Valley, the 10th West Coast Computer Fair recently closed. It's a significant fair because it's one of the oldest and largest in the world, and trends seen there appear later in Europe and Asia. This year, although there were the same number of exhibitors, they were different than last, many having gone out of business. With the news that the home computer market has found a saturation point in some parts of the United States, Media Network's Sean Maffett talked to John Dvorak. He's a computer industry analyst and writer for magazines such as Computer World.
I think most of the computer uses in the home will eventually become transparent to the homeowner.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's computers in your videotape recorder, there's computers in the microwave oven. Essentially, the microprocessor is starting to show up. It's inside cars, that's where the computer will show up. When it comes to just using a computer for no apparent reason, like or for something like recipe filing, which is really much better done in a card file than it is in a computer. I mean, it takes longer to start a decent computer up than it does to just quickly flip through a card file and find the recipe. It's some of these uses that people have imagined for home computers seem rather ludicrous when you start thinking about it.
So you're saying then that actually there isn't all that much use for the straight computer per se in the home. Does that perhaps account for the fact that we seem to be taking a dip and computer firms are going out of business all over the place? For instance, the BBC Micro is in trouble, Apple are in trouble, IBM have just stopped making their personal computer?
Well, Apple's luckily positioned themselves as kind of a high-end home computer that, you know, you have to take seriously. It's the low-ball guys, the guys who tried to bring out the real cheap item, or IBM kind of bringing out an item that was too expensive but should have been cheaper. For the life of me, I never could figure out, when people started talking about home computers, I try to imagine what it was like when I was a kid. What would my parents do with this thing? I couldn't imagine a damn thing. My father would work all day, come home, and he'd watch television. My mother would cook, you know, and keep the house clean. None of the functions that they did that I can recall were anything that would be improved by a computer.
What about the things that we keep having pushed at us, banking and shopping from the home?
The whole shopping concept, to me, always ignored what really makes shopping work, which is merchandising. And just the plain text on a screen where you don't get to see the thing. People like to squeeze goods. They like to go out. At no time do you ever see any indication that people would rather stay at home and flip through a catalog that's printed or on a computer. On the Source and CompuServe, you can get the official airline guide, and it costs like an extra $35 an hour. And on the official airline guide, you can look up all the airline flights and figure out the cheapest fare. Typically, you'll save $10 or $20 on the fare because most of the prices are fixed anyway. When you look at your bill for going through the official airline guide, it costs more to get the cheap fare just to find it than it would be if you just called the travel agent. Home banking is the same way. There's really, since you can't make a deposit, it just, what's the point?
So for a computer buff, you sound to be quite pessimistic about the future for the home computer industry.
For that segment, that chunk that we're talking about, that where people are anticipating these artificial uses that may not exist, sure, I don't have any positive attitude. I think the home computer, like I said, is great for students, it's good for people who work at home, it's good for writers, it's good for people who may have to be on a terminal at work, but that's not the home computer. No, the home computer is never going to make it, as far as I can tell.
Africa Media News Desk.
And joining us now is Richard Jinby.
A couple of weeks ago, I reported the voice of Kenya's general service on 4885 kilohertz. This transmitter continues to be heard at sign-on 0300 through until 0330 when they switch over to a vernacular service, with the general service once again coming through around 1800 hours until sign-off at 2010 or 2110 at weekends.
Beginning service of the voice of Kenya Nairobi. It is 9 o'clock.
This is the only VOK transmitter currently audible. Tests from their new 250 kilowatt transmitters have yet to appear. Swazi Radio has abandoned 9703 kilohertz in favor of 4980 Mondays to Fridays and Sundays 0800 to 1400, Saturdays 1100 to 1400 hours UTC. The period 0600, Sundays 0500 to 0800 hours is 100 kilowatts on this frequency. The Central African Republic appears to have put on the air their long-planned 100 kilowatt medium-wave transmitter. Bongi is often noted at 1900 hours on 1440 in parallel to shortwave 5035 kilohertz. So that's a new medium-wave frequency for the Central African Republic, 1440. An unusual frequency now for Radio Zambia, 8948 kHz. It was noted one Sunday between 10:50 and 12:30 hours, as none of the regulars 9505, 11880 or 17895 kilohertz were on the air at the time. It appeared that the transmitter was badly mistuned, but what was the original meant to be, I wonder? The clandestine station Voice of Truth, located somewhere in South Africa, has been noted closing down at the odd hour of 03:30. Normally, that's when the sign-on is. They were followed by 25 minutes of non-stop music. All that on 4950 kHz and at the time in upper sideband. However, of late, 4950, as well as Radio Truth on 5015 and the no-name Spanish broadcast on 6045, have switched back to standard AM, but who knows how long for. Finally, since the beginning of the month, the SABC's pop music station, Radio 5, has been in AM stereo, using the SEQAM system, and with high power, 100 kilowatts on 576 kilohertz.
Jennifer Rush, that is, on 5 on this Tuesday morning. And a ring of ice. Cold engagement, one might say. Oops.
That recording was made during a test transmission in March at 07:30 hours UTC, and it was recorded at a location 300 kilometers away from the transmitting site.
Thanks, Richard. And now, back to Europe.
Radio Luxembourg.
China and Luxembourg's commercial broadcast company, RTL, have agreed to exchange musical programs and to allow European commercials on Chinese radio and television, Radio Luxembourg announced last Wednesday. RTL is a mixed Belgium-French company and will handle the sales of European commercials to be broadcast in China through its subsidiary, Information à Publicité, RTL spokesman Ferdinand Kaiser said. But, he added, it was not yet determined when the exchange of programs and the sales of European commercials in China will start. And, in a departure from its traditional policy, China will pay copyright fees for the RTL shows.
Well, this past week it's been busy in Omdurman, the capital of Sudan, where the government changed hands rather suddenly. And on the line is Andy Sennett of the World Radio TV Handbook in Copenhagen, who's been watching the events from a shortwave media point of view.
Yes, well, we're not able to hear the domestic service very well in Europe, but as soon as I heard the news on Saturday morning, I instinctively tuned to 17940 kilohertz. Now, that's the frequency used by the Voice of the Sudanese Popular Revolution, a station which uses transmitters in Libya.
That's 17940.
That's right. And the regular transmission time had been approximately 14 to 1700 UTC. But on Saturday, when I tuned in, it was already on the air before 1200. And in fact, it stayed on well past its normal sign-off. And yesterday, Wednesday, I put the receiver on in the office and heard the station come on the air at 10:23 UTC with some Sudanese music and the opening announcement at 10:32, so nominally it signed on around 10:30. The interesting thing is that a few weeks ago, this station incorporated the broadcast of another clandestine, Radio SPLA, which is operated by the Sudan People's Liberation Army. Now, Radio SPLA had been noted between 16 and 1700 UTC on 17940 prior to last weekend's events, but of course this may now have altered. And if you're following the news, you'll know that the future relationship between the various groups in Sudan is still very uncertain. So I think this is going to be a very interesting frequency in the coming weeks.
And as you can hear, 17940 kHz was putting an excellent signal into this part of the world at 1330 UTC yesterday. Well, talking of clandestine stations, here's John Campbell now, our clandestine columnist, to follow up a query from listener John Richardson, who lives in Singapore. He heard us mention the book Secret Warfare a few months back by Pierre Laurin as an excellent account of clandestine radio during the Second World War in Europe. So what about since then?
So far, there's no book that I know of that's written specifically for people who'd be, say, regular listeners to Media Network. But there's a good substitute, or series of substitutes. Many of you have probably already heard of the series of annual publications about military aircraft and ships and things like that, which begin with the name Janes. But there are other series too, and the one I want to mention today is called Janes Military Communications. The latest annual edition is always fairly expensive, but there are two advantages in looking for copies that are a few years old. Firstly, if they're on sale in second-hand bookshops or in sales, they'll be a lot cheaper. I've just bought the 1981 edition for about $7. Secondly, the ones that are a few years old are more likely to be talking about equipment that you might someday in the near future find on the disposals market or on some kind of fairly open market. You'll find that there are modern versions of the kind of miniaturized equipment and specialized communications receivers and transceivers that you can read about in Lorrain's book called Secret Warfare, but you'll also find new types of equipment mentioned there, ones, for example, which rely on communication techniques like spread-spectrum communications, as they're called, or techniques of frequency hopping, not to mention things like electronic countermeasures. These are all areas that deserve full-scale programs to themselves, and maybe if Media Network thinks it right, I may come back and talk about those at some stage in the future. But for the moment, those of you who want to know what's going on in 1985 to match up with what is already widely known about clandestine radio in 1945 should keep an eye open, either in reference libraries or in book sales, for copies of Janes Military Communications. Now, last month, I talked about some Iranian clandestine broadcasting, in particular broadcasting from an outfit calling itself the Iranian Communist Party. That station, with the original name, hasn't shown up again this year, as far as I know. But another station has shown up on what looks like the same schedule and with at least one of the same frequencies. And it's quite likely that this station belongs to the same organization or can be contacted in the same way or has the same point of view. The station is called Sedaye Fedai, or Voice of the Fedayeen, or Guerrillas, and I've now managed to hear it for myself this year in parallel on two frequencies, 3941 kilohertz and 4680 kilohertz. The schedule varies by a few minutes, but it tends to come on the air just before 17 hours UTC, and it closes down on, or maybe slightly after, 18 hours UTC. I didn't succeed to hear this station in England, but I heard it in Denmark when I was visiting my good friend Finn Kroner, who does the DX program News for Adventist World Radio. I'm not quite sure if I should be advertising competitors over Radio Netherlands, but I'll do it anyway and rely on Dutch goodwill to get away with it. And we logged the station on successive days with quite good signal strength. It doesn't seem to play the Internationale now on sign-off, and the last 5 minutes I spent giving out what sound like coded numbers messages to either guerrilla groups or friends. It's anybody's guess whether these coded number groups are meaningful or whether they are simply there to cheer up the faithful and make them believe that some kind of guerrilla activity is actually on the march.
Thanks, John. Well, we regard Finn Kroner spotted 0815 UTC on 9670 kHz each Sunday as one of the best sources of DX tips there is. He has the advantage, of course, of being able to concentrate on what's being heard here in Europe for European listeners, and he does an excellent job. So I hope we can regard him as a colleague rather than a competitor. Now let me say goodbye to listeners who've loaded a C60 cassette into their tape machine this week to tape this programme. Your tape's just about to run out. But for normal listeners like you and I, we continue with two final items. First, since the start of April, we've been trying to contact the Danish equipment firm of Esker to look into the reason for the nearly 16-month delay to their announced super general coverage receiver, the RX99PL. Although some reviews have already appeared, we were told by Esker 4 weeks ago that only three examples of this superset actually exist. Not really much of a production run. And more recently, listeners mentioned difficulty in getting hold of the company. Well, since the start of April, we've been trying their advertised number. A tape mentioned that they were closed for business until the 9th of April. But since then, as you can hear, although the number rings, it doesn't answer. But we have had reaction from you as to our computer propagation prediction program called Micromuff 2, available free. And joining me now is its author, Hans Backhausen of Radio Netherlands Frequency Bureau.
I received a lot of letters, Jonathan. A number of listeners had suggestions. The most interesting one so far has been a letter from Mr. Onken in Germany, who is experimenting with a long path mode, an adaptation to my original program.
What does that mean, that if you choose two points, for example, Hilversum and Invercargill, New Zealand, it normally calculates the propagation only on the short way around the world?
Yes, that's right. Well, and in this particular case, Mr. Onken decided to calculate the path between New Zealand and Europe.
The long way around.
The long way around, yes. And he found out that the practice actually corresponds to the predictions. And that's good news, of course. We're talking about 30,000 kilometers or so.
But that means some changes to the existing program.
That's right. And I'm considering a new Micromuff 3 version. Remember that the old Micromuff 2 version is only 4 weeks old.
Well, we're talking about September before that's ready.
Yeah, that's right, Jonathan. I'm only considering the possibility.
Other suggestions too?
Yes, that's right. On entering high sunspot numbers, over 150 or so, in some cases the maximum usable frequency can rise up till 40 megahertz or so. And in that case, the hard copy routine could crash. But not for the coming 4 or 5 years with the low sunspot numbers.
Okay, you've had suggestions, you've had comments about it, generally favourable, people have got it working. Anything else?
Yes, unfortunately there is a bug in the listing. What is on line 1030, 1030, should be on line 2310, 2310. And in line 1940, 1940, part of the text is missing, unfortunately. It should read, if AE is smaller than 1.5, then 1870.
Sounds like a secret code, but those minor corrections have been made to the free Micromuff listings going out as from next week. If you're using the program, you may like to know that the current sunspot number measured yesterday is just 9 spots. The estimated A index is 12, and the Boulder K index at 05 hours UTC this Thursday morning was measured at 3. There was a minor magnetic storm affecting radio conditions back on Tuesday, and the forecast for the next 24 hours is for continued low solar activity, while the geomagnetic field will be unsettled to active. Possibly bad news for all of us shortwave broadcasters, including new religious station WMLK in Bethel, Pennsylvania, USA, which we're told from telephone reaction to our answer line this morning was testing 15110 kilohertz last night, beamed to Europe with a full 50 kilowatts of power at 18 hours UTC. A call to the transmitter site indicates that they're not quite ready for a full broadcast service yet, as the frequency synthesizer on the transmitter is playing up. But they hope to solve that within a few days. Well, I hope that never happens to us. And this is Jonathan Mark saying goodbye for now. And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.